and shoulders ripped it out of the socket. More blood splashed out, if only for a second, without a heartbeat to keep pumping it. Blood loss is mostly about leakage. And then the mortally crippled vampire fell, twitching and dying as the stake of wood through its heart put an end to its unlife. I felt Drulinda coming more than I saw it happen, the cold presence of a black court vampire in a fury rubbing abrasively against my wizard senses.
Thomas!
My brother turned in time to duck a blow so swift I didn't even see it. He returned it with one of his own, but Drulinda, though new to the trade, was a master vampire, a creature with its own terrible will and power. Thomas had fought other black court vamps before, but not a master. He was on the defensive from the outset. Though my brother was unthinkably strong and swift when drawing upon his vampiric nature, he wasn't strong or swift enough. I lay sprawled on the ground, still half paralyzed by the pain in the left half of my body, and tried to think of what to do next.
"Get out!"
I screamed at the bistro.
"Get out of here, people! Get the hell out now!"
While I screamed, Drulinda slammed my brother's back into a metal security grate so hard that it left a broad smear of his pale red blood on its bars. People started hurrying out of the bistro, running for the parking lot. Drulinda looked over her shoulder and let out another hissing squall of rage. At this opening, Thomas managed to get a grip on her arm, set his feet, and swing her into the wall, sending cracks streaking through the concrete. On the rebound, he swung her up and around and then down, smashing her down onto the floor, then up from that and into a security mesh again, crushing tile and bending metal with every impact. I heard a scream and looked up to see Anhui fall from her impossibly high black heels in her tiny tight black dress as she tried to flee the bistro. A horribly disfigured hand had reached out from the rubble over the crushed vampire, and now it held her. I ran for the girl as my brother laid into Drulinda. My left arm wasn't talking to me, and I fumbled the second canister out of my left jacket pocket with my right arm, then dumped garlic over the outstretched vampire's hand. It began smoking and spasming. Anhui screamed as the crushing grip broke her ankle. I stood up in frustration and started stomping down on the vampire's arm. Supernaturally strong it might be, but its bones were made of bone, and it couldn't maintain its grip on the girl without them. It took a lot of stomping, but I was finally able to pull the girl free. I tried to get Anhui to her feet, but her weight came down on her broken ankle, and from there, it came down on my wounded shoulder. I went down to one knee, and it was all I could do not to fall. I almost didn't notice when my brother flew through the air just over my head, smashed out what had to be the last remaining pane of glass at the mall entrance, and landed limply in the parking lot. I felt Drulinda's presence coming up behind me. The vampire let out a dusty laugh.
"I thought it was just some poor pretty boy to play with. Silly me."
I fumbled with the canister for a second and then whirled, flinging its contents at Drulinda in a slewing arc. The vampire blurred to one side, dodging the garlic with ease. She looked battered and was covered with dust. Her undead flesh was approximately the consistency of wood, and so it wasn't cut and damaged so much as chipped and crushed. Her clothes were torn and ruined, and none of that mattered. She was just as functional and just as deadly as she had been before the fight. I dropped the canister and drew forth my pentacle amulet, lifting it as a talisman against her. The old bit with the crucifix works on the black court, but it isn't purely about Christianity. They are repelled not by the holy symbol itself, but by the faith of the one holding it up against them. I'd seen vampires repulsed by crosses, crucifixes, strips of paper written with holy symbols by a Shinto priest, once even a Star of David. Me, I used the pentacle, because that's what I believed in. The five-pointed star, to me, represented the five elements of earth, air, water, fire, and spirit, bound within the solid circle of mortal will. I believed that magic was a force intended to be used to create, to protect, and to preserve. I believed that magic was a gift that had to be used responsibly and wisely, and that it especially had to be used against creatures like Drulinda, against literal personified evil, to protect those who couldn't protect themselves. That's what I thought, and I'd spent my life acting in accordance with it. I believed. pale blue light began to spill from the symbol, and Drulinda stopped with a hiss of sudden rage.
"You,"
she said after a few seconds.
"I have heard of you, the wizard, Dresden."
I nodded slowly. Behind her, the fire from my earlier spell was spreading. The power was out, and I had no doubt that Drulinda and her former security guard lackeys had disabled the alarms. It wouldn't take long for a fire to go insane in this place once it got its teeth sunk in. We needed to get out. "Go," I mumbled at Anhui. She sobbed and started crawling for the exit while I held Drulinda off with the amulet. The vampire stared steadily at me for a second, her eyes all milky white, corpse cataracts glinting in the reflected light of the fire. Then she smiled and moved. She was just too damn fast. I tried to turn to keep up with her, but by the time I did, Anhui screamed, and Drulinda had seized her hair and dragged her back out of the immediate circle of light cast by the amulet. She lifted the struggling girl with ease so that I could see her mascara-streaked face.
"Wizard!"
Drulinda said. Anhui had been cut by flying glass or the fall at some point, and some blood had streaked out of her slicked back hair over her ear and down one side of her throat. The vampire leaned in, extending a tongue like a strip of beef jerky, and licked blood from the girl's skin.
"You can hide behind your light, but you can't save her."
I ground my teeth and said nothing.
"But your death will profit me. Grant me standing with others of my kind. The feared and vaunted wizard Dresden."
She bared yellowed teeth in a smile.
"So, I offer you this bargain. Throw away the amulet. I will let the girl go. You have my word."
She leaned her teeth in close and brushed them over the girl's neck.
"Otherwise, well, all of my new friends are gone. I'll have to make more."
That made me shudder. Dying was one thing. Dying and being made into one of those. I lowered the amulet. I hesitated for a second, and then dropped it. Drulinda let out a low, eager sound and tossed Anhui aside like an empty candy wrapper. Then she was on me, letting out rasping giggles, for God's sake, pressing me down.
"I can smell your fear, wizard," she rasped. "I think I'm going to enjoy this."
She leaned closer, slowly, as she bared her teeth, her face only inches from mine. Which is where I wanted her to be. I reared up my head and spat out a gooey mouthful of powdered garlic directly into those cataract eyes. Drulinda let out a scream, bounding away in a violent rush, clawing at her eyes with her fingers and getting them burned too. She thrashed in wild agony, swinging randomly at anything she touched or bumped into, tearing great gaping gashes in metal fences, smashing holes in concrete walls. "Couple words of advice," I growled, my mouth burning with the remains of the garlic I'd stuffed it with as she'd come sneaking up on me. "First, any time I'm not shooting my mouth off to a cliched two-bit creature of the night like you, it's because I'm up to something." Drulinda howled more and rushed toward me, tripping on some rubble and sprawling on the ground, only to rush about on all fours like some kind of ungainly, horrible insect. I checked behind me. Anhui was already out, and Thomas was beginning to stir, maybe roused by the snow now falling on him. I turned back to the blinded, pain-maddened vampire. We were the only ones left in that wing of the mall. "Second," I spat. "Never touch my brother on his fucking birthday!" I reached for my will, lifted my hand, and snarled, "Fuego!" Fire roared out to eagerly engulf the vampire. What the hell? The building was burning down anyway. "Freaking amateur villains," I muttered, glowering down at the splatters on my car. Thomas leaned against it with one hand pressed to his head, a grimace of pain on his face. "You okay?" I waved my left arm a little. "Feelings coming back. I'll have Butters check me out later. Thanks for loaning Molly your car." "Least I could do. Let her drive Sarah and Anhui to the hospital." He squinted at the rising smoke from the mall. "Think the whole thing will go?" "Nah," I said. This wing, maybe. They'll get here before too much more goes up. Keith and his folks should be all right. My brother grunted. How are they going to explain this one? Who knows, I said. Meteor, maybe. Smashed holes in the roof, crushed some poor security guard, set the place on fire. My vote is for terrorists, Thomas said. Terrorists are real popular these days. He shook his head. But I mean the LARPers, not the cops. Oh, I said. Probably they won't talk to anyone about what they saw, afraid people would think they were crazy. And they would, Thomas said. And they would, I agreed. Come tomorrow, it will seem very unreal. A few months from now, they'll wonder if they didn't imagine some of it, or if there was some kind of gas leak or something that made them hallucinate. Give it a few more years, and they'll remember that Drulinda and some rough-looking types showed up to give them a hard time. They drove a car through the front of the mall. Maybe they were crazy people dressed in costumes who had been to a few too many LARPs themselves. I shook my head. It's human nature to try to understand and explain everything. The world is less scary that way. But I don't think they'll be in any danger, really. No more so than anyone else. That's good, Thomas said quietly. I guess. It's the way it is. In the distance, sirens were starting up and coming closer. I grunted and said, We better go. Yeah. We got into the Beetle. I started it up and we headed out. I left the lights off, no sense attracting attention. You gonna be all right? I asked him. He nodded. Take me a few days to get enough back into me to feel normal, but he shrugged. I'll make it. Thanks for the backup, I said. Kick their freaky asses, he said, and held out his fist. I wrapped my knuckles lightly against it. Nice signal, the birthday present. I figured you'd get it, I said. Then I frowned. Crap, I said. Your present. You didn't remember to bring it? I was a little busy, I said. He was quiet for a minute. Then he asked, What was it? Rock'em sock'em robots, I said. He blinked at me. What? I repeated myself. The little plastic robots you make fight. I know what they are, Harry, he responded. I'm trying to figure out why you'd give me them. I pursed my lips for a minute. Then I said, Right after my dad died, they put me in an orphanage. It was Christmas time. On television, they had commercials for Rock'em Sock'em robots. Two kids playing with them, you know? Two brothers. I shrugged. That was a year when I really, really wanted to give those stupid plastic robots to my brother. Because it would mean you weren't alone, Thomas said quietly. Yeah, I said. Sorry I forgot them. And happy birthday. He glanced back at the burning mall. Well, my brother said, I suppose it's the thought that counts. Heorot, from My Big Fat Supernatural Honeymoon, edited by P. N. Elrod, takes place between White Knight and Small Favor. Once more, Pat invited me to come play at her literary clubhouse, and once more I cheerfully agreed. What can I say? I fear change. The last anthology's theme had been weddings, and this one was the logical sequel, honeymoons. Research into the etymology of honeymoon led me back to its roots in Scandinavia and in the British Isles, where a newly wed bride and groom would depart their village and remain in solitude for a lunar month while being well provided with mead, which is made from honey. I think the idea was to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that any child conceived in that time was the legitimate heir of the groom. Or maybe it was just to get a pretty young bride liquored up and wild for a month. Viking girls gone wild, as it were. I have no idea if the information I found, mostly on the internet, was academically accurate. For my purposes, that wasn't nearly as important as finding a solid inspiration. So, from newlyweds, mead, and Norse Scandinavian backgrounds, I developed a story using everything from the Dresden Files storyline that had the flimsiest of connections to those base ideas. I put them all together, plopped Harry down in the middle of it, and gleefully watched as it caught fire. I was sitting in my office sorting through my bills when Mac called and said, I need your help. It was the first time I'd heard him use four whole words altogether like that. Okay, I said. Where? I'd out-tersed him. Another first. Loon Island Pub, Max said. Wrigleyville. On the way. I hung up, stood up, put on my black leather duster, and said to my dog, "We're on the job." My dog, Mouse, who outweighs most European cars, bounced up eagerly from where he dozed near my office's single heating vent. He shook out his thick gray fur, especially the shaggy, almost leonine ruff growing heavy on his neck and shoulders, and we set out to help a friend. October had brought in more rain and more cold than usual, and that day we had both, plus wind. I found parking for my battered old Volkswagen Bug, hunched my shoulders under my leather duster, and walked north along Clark into the wind, Mouse keeping pace at my side. Loon Island Pub was in sight of Wrigley Field, and a popular hangout before and after games. Bigger than most such businesses, it could host several hundred people throughout its various rooms and levels. Outside, large posters had been plastered to the brick siding of the building. Though the posters were soaked with rain, you could still read Chicago Beer Association and Night of the Living Brews, followed by an announcement of a home-brewed beer festival and competition with today's date on it. There was a lot of foot traffic in and out. "Aha," I told Mouse. "Explains why Mac is here instead of at his own place. He's finally unleashed the new dark on the unsuspecting public." Mouse glanced up at me rather reproachfully from under his shaggy brows. Then he lowered his head, sighed, and continued plodding against the rain until we gained the pub. Mac was waiting for us at the front door. He was a sinewy, bald man dressed in dark slacks and a white shirt somewhere between the age of 30 and 50. He had a very average, unremarkable face, one that usually wore a steady expression of patience and contemplation. Today, though, that expression was what I could only describe as grim. I came in out of the rain and passed off my 6-foot oak staff to Mac to hold for me as I shrugged out of my duster. I shook the garment thoroughly, sending raindrops sheeting from it, and promptly put it back on. Mac runs the pub where the supernatural community of Chicago does most of its hanging out. His place has seen more than his share of paranormal nasties, and if Mac looked that worried, I wanted to spell reinforced leather of the duster between my tender skin and the source of his concern. I took the staff back from Mac, who nodded to me, and then crouched down to Mouse, who had gravely offered a paw to shake. Mac shook, ruffled Mouse's ears, and said, "Missing girl." I nodded, scarcely noticing the odd looks I was getting from several of the people inside. That was par for the course. "What do we know?" "Husband," Mac said. He jerked his head at me, and I followed him deeper into the pub. Mouse stayed pressed against my side, his tail wagging in a friendly fashion. I suspected the gesture was an affectation. Mouse is an awful lot of dog, and people get nervous if he doesn't act overtly friendly. Mac led me through a couple of rooms where each table and booth had been claimed by a different brewer. Homemade signs bearing a gratuitous number of exclamation points touted the various concoctions, except for the one Mac stopped at. There, a cardstock table tent was neatly lettered, simply reading McAnally's Dark. At the booth next to Mac's, a young man, good-looking in a reedy, librarian-esque kind of way, was talking to a police officer while wringing his hands. "But you don't get it," the young man said. "She wouldn't just leave. Not today. We start our honeymoon tonight." The cop, a stocky, balding fellow whose nose was perhaps more red than warranted by the weather outside, shook his head. "Sir, I'm sorry, but she's been gone for, what, an hour or two? We don't even start to look until 24 hours have passed."
"She wouldn't just leave,"
the young man half shouted. "Look, kid," the cop said. "It wouldn't be the first time some guy's new wife panicked and ran off. You want my advice? Start calling up her old boyfriends."
"But..."
The cop thumped a finger into the young man's chest. "Get over it, buddy. Come back in 24 hours. He turned to walk away from the young man and almost bumped into me. He took a step back and scowled up at me. "You want something?" "Just basking in the glow of your compassion, officer," I replied. His face darkened into a scowl, but before he could take a deep breath and start throwing his weight around, Mac pushed a mug of his dark ale into the cop's hand. The cop slugged it back immediately. He swished the last gulp around in his mouth, purely for form, then tossed the mug back at McAnally, belched, and went on his way. Mr. McAnally, the young man said, turning to Mac. Thank goodness. I still haven't seen her. He looked at me. Is this him? Mac nodded. I stuck out my hand. Harry Dresden. Roger Braddock, the anxious young man said. Someone has abducted my wife. He gripped too hard, and his fingers were cold and a little clammy. I wasn't sure what was going on here, but Braddock was genuinely afraid. Abducted her? Did you see it happen? Well, he said, no, not really. No one did. But she wouldn't just walk out, not today. We got married this morning, and we're leaving on our honeymoon tonight, soon as the festival is over. I arched an eyebrow. You put your honeymoon on hold to go to a beer festival? I'm opening my own place, Braddock said. Mr. McAnally has been giving me advice, sort of mentoring me. This was, I've been here every year, and it's only once a year, and the prestige from a win is the networking, and... His voice trailed off as he looked around. Yeah, the looming specter of sudden loss has a way of making you reevaluate things. Sometimes it's tough to know what's really important until you realize it might be gone. You two were at this booth, I prompted. Yes, he said. He licked his lips. She went to pick up some napkins from the bar right over there. She wasn't 20 feet away, and somehow she just vanished. Personally, I was more inclined to go with the cops' line of reasoning than the kids'. People in general tend to be selfish, greedy, and unreliable. There are individual exceptions, of course, but no one ever wants to believe that the petty portions of human nature might have come between themselves and someone they care about. The kid seemed awfully sincere, but endearing, awfully sincere people, their decisions driven mostly by their emotions, are capable of being mistaken on an epic scale. The worse the situation looks, the harder they'll search for reasons not to believe it. It seemed more likely that his girl left him than that someone took her away. On the other hand, likely isn't the same as true, and Mac isn't the kind to cry wolf. How long you two been together? I asked Braddock. Since we were 15, he replied. An anemic smile fluttered around his mouth. Almost 10 years. Making it official, huh? We both knew when it was right, he replied. He lost the smile. Just like I know she didn't walk away. Not unless someone made her do it. I stepped around Braddock and studied the high-backed booth for a moment. A keg sat on the table next to a little cardstock sign that had a cartoon bee decked out with a Viking-style helmet, a baldric, and a greatsword. Words beneath the bee proclaimed Braddock's Midnight Sun Cinnamon. I grunted and reached down, pulling a simple black leather lady's purse from beneath the bench seating. Not an expensive purse, either. Not much chance she'd walk without taking her bag, I said. That's for damn sure. Braddock bit his lip, closed his eyes, and said, Elizabeth. I sighed. Well, damn it. Now she had a name. Elizabeth Braddock, newlywed. Maybe she'd just run off, but maybe she hadn't. I didn't think I would like myself very much if I walked and it turned out that she really was in danger and really did get hurt. What the hell? No harm in looking around. I guess the game's afoot, I said. I gestured vaguely with the purse. May I? Sure, Braddock said. Sure, sure. I dumped Elizabeth's purse out onto the booth's table behind the beer keg and began rummaging through it. The usual, a wallet, some makeup, a cell phone, Kleenex, some feminine sanitary sundries, one of those plastic birth control pill holders with a folded piece of paper taped to it. And there was a hairbrush, an antique-looking thing with a long, pointy silver handle. I plucked several strands of dark, wavy hair from the brush. Is this your wife's hair? Braddock blinked at me for a second, then nodded. Yes, of course. Mind if I borrow this? He didn't. I pocketed the brush for the moment and glanced at the birth control pill case. I opened it. Only the first several slots were empty. I untaped the folded paper and opened it, finding instructions for the medicine's use. Who keeps the instructions sheet, for crying out loud? While I pondered it, a shadow fell across Braddock, and a beefy, heavily tattooed arm shoved him back against the spine of the partition between booths. I looked up the arm to the beefy, heavily tattooed bruiser attached to it. He was only a couple of inches shorter than me, and layered with muscle gone to seed. He was bald and sported a bristling beard. Scar tissue around his eyes told me he'd been a fighter, and a lumpy, often broken nose suggested that he might not have been much good at it. He wore black leather and rings heavy enough to serve as passable brass knuckles on every finger of his right hand. His voice was like the rest of him, thick and dull. He flung a little triangle of folded cardstock at Braddock.
"Where's my keg, Braddock?"
"Kane," Braddock stammered. "What are you talking about?"
"My keg, bitch," the big man snarled.
A couple of guys who wished they were more like Kane lurked behind him, propping up his ego.
"It's gone. You figure you couldn't take the competition this year?"
I glanced at the fallen table tent. It also had a little Wagnerian cartoon B on it and the lettering Kane's Kick-Ass.
"I don't have time for this," Braddock said.
Kane shoved him back against the booth again, harder.
"We ain't done. Stay put, bitch, unless you want me to feed you your ass."
I glanced at Mac, who stared at Kane, frowning but not doing anything. Mac doesn't like to get involved. He's smarter than I am. I stepped forward, seized Kane's hand in mine, and pumped it enthusiastically.
"Hi there! Harry Dresden, P.I. How you doing?"
I nodded at him, smiling, and smiled at his friends, too.
"Hey, are you allergic to dogs?"
Kane was so startled that he almost forgot to try crushing my hand in his. When he got around to it, it hurt enough that I had to work not to wince. I'm not heavily built, but I'm more than 6.5 feet tall, and it takes more strength than most have to make me feel it.
"What?" he said wittily. "Dog what?"
"Allergic to dogs," I clarified and nodded down at Mouse.
"Occasionally someone has a bad reaction to my dog, and I hate that to happen here."
The biker scowled at me and then looked down. 200 pounds of Mouse, not acting at all friendly now, stared steadily at Kane. Mouse didn't show any teeth or growl. He didn't need to. He just stared. Kane lifted his lips up from his teeth in an ugly little smile, but he released my hand with a jerk and then sneered at Braddock.
"Say, where's that pretty little piece of yours? She run off to find a real man?"
Braddock might have been a sliver over half of Kane's size, but he went after the biker with complete sincerity and without a second thought. This time Mac moved, interposing himself between Braddock and Kane, getting a shoulder against Braddock's chest. The older man braced himself and shoved Braddock back from the brink of a beating, though the younger man cursed and struggled against him. Kane let out an ugly laugh and stepped forward, his big hands closing into fists. I leaned my staff so that he stepped into it, the blunt tip of the wood thrusting solidly against the hollow of his throat. He made a noise that sounded like glurk and stepped back, scowling ferociously at me. I tugged my staff back against my chest so that I could hold up both hands, palms out, just as the dumpy cop, attracted by Braddock's thumping and cursing, came into the room with one hand on his nightstick.
"Easy there, big guy," I said, loud enough to make sure the cop heard. "The kid's just upset on account of his wife. He doesn't mean anything by it."
The bruiser lifted one closed fist as if he meant to drive it at my noggin, but one of his two buddies said urgently,
"Cop!"
Kane froze and glanced back over his shoulder. The officer might have been overweight, but he looked like he knew how to throw it around, and he had a club and a gun besides, never mind all the other uniforms theoretically behind him. Kane opened his fist, showing an empty hand, and lowered it again.
"Sure," he said. "Sure. Misunderstanding. Happened to anybody."
"You want to walk away," the cop told Kane. "Do it now. Otherwise you get a ride."
Kane and company departed in sullen silence, glaring daggers at me. Well, glaring letter openers anyway. Kane didn't seem real sharp. The cop stalked over to me more lightly than he should have been able to. No question about it, the man knew how to play rough. He looked at me, then at my staff, and kept his nightstick in his hand.
"You Dresden?"
"Uh-huh," I said.
"Heard of you. Work for Special Investigations sometimes. Call yourself a wizard."
"That's right."
"You know Rawlins?"
"Good man," I said.
The cop grunted.
He jerked his head toward the departing Kane as he put the stick away.
"Guy's a con. A hard case, too. Likes hurting people. You keep your eyes open, Mr. Wizard, or he'll make some of your teeth disappear."
"Yeah," I said. "Golly, he's scary." The cop eyed me, then snorted and said,
"Your dentures." He nodded and walked out again, probably tailing Kane to make sure he left. The cop and Kane weren't all that different in some ways. The cop would have loved to take his stick to Kane's head as much as Kane had wanted to swat mine. They were both damn near equally sensitive about Braddock's missing wife, too. But at least the cop had channeled his inner thug into something that helped out the people around him, as long as he didn't have to run up too many stairs, I guessed. I turned back to Mac and found him still standing between the kid and the door. Mac nodded his thanks to me. Braddock looked like he might be about to start crying, or maybe start screaming. "No love lost there, huh?" I said to Braddock. The kid snarled at the empty space where Kane had been.
"Elizabeth embarrassed him once. He doesn't take rejection well, and he never forgets. Do you think he did it?"
"Not really. Mac," I asked, "something tipped you off that this was from the spooky side. Lights flicker?" Mac grunted, twice. Braddock stared at Mac and then at me. "What does that have to do with anything?"
"Active magic tends to interfere with electrical systems," I said. "It'll disrupt cell phones, screw up computers. Simpler things like the lights usually just flicker a bit."
Braddock had a look somewhere between uncertainty and nausea on his face.
"Magic? You're kidding, right?"
"I'm tired of having this conversation," I said. I reached into my pocket for Elizabeth Braddock's fallen hairs. "This joint got a back door?"
Mac pointed silently.
"Thanks," I said. "Come on, Mouse." The back door opened into a long, narrow, dirty alley running parallel to Clark. The wind had picked up, which meant that the cold rain was mostly striking the upper portion of one wall of the alley. Good for me. It's tough to get a solid spell put together under even a moderate rain. When it's really coming down, it's all but impossible, even for a relatively simple working, such as a tracking spell. I'd done this hundreds of times, and by now it was pretty routine. I found a clear spot of concrete in the lee of the sheltering wall and sketched a quick circle around me with a piece of chalk, investing the motion with a deliberate effort of will. As I completed the circle, I felt the immediate result, a screen of energy that rose up from the circle, enfolding me and warding out any random energy that might skew the spell. I took off my necklace, a silver chain with a battered old silver pentacle hanging from it, murmuring quietly, and tied several of Elizabeth's hairs through the center of the pentacle. After that, I gathered up my will, feeling the energy focused by the circle into something almost tangible, whispered in faux Latin, and released the gathered magic into the pentacle. The silver five-pointed star flickered once, a dozen tiny sparks of static electricity fluttering over the metal surface and the hairs bound inside it. I grimaced. I'd been sloppy to let some of the energy convert itself into static, and I'd been harping on my apprentice about the need for precision for a week. I broke the circle by smudging the chalk with one foot and glanced at Mouse, who sat patiently, mouth open in a doggy grin. Mouse had been there for some of those lessons, and he was smarter than the average dog. How much smarter remained to be seen, but I got the distinct impression he was laughing at me. "It was the rain," I told him. Mouse sneezed, tail wagging. I glowered at him. I'm not sure I could take it if my dog was smarter than me. The falling rain would wash away the spell on the amulet if I left it out in the open, so I shielded it as carefully as I could with the building in my hand. A hat would have come in handy for that purpose, actually. Maybe I should get one. I held up the amulet, focusing on the spell. It quivered on the end of its chain, then swung toward the far end of the alley in a sharp, sudden motion. I drew my hand and the amulet back up into the sleeve of my duster, whistling. She came right down this alley, and judging by the strength of the reaction, she was scared bad, left a really big trail. At that, Mouse made a chuffing sound and started down the alley, snuffling. The end of his short lead, mostly there for appearance's sake, dragged the ground. I kept pace, and by the time Mouse was 20 yards down the alley, he had begun growling, low in his throat. That was an occasion worth a raised eyebrow. Mouse didn't make noise unless there was something bad around. He increased his pace, and I lengthened my stride to keep up. I found myself growling along with him. I'd gotten sick of bad things visiting themselves upon people in my town a long time ago. When we hit the open street, Mouse slowed. Magic wasn't the only thing that a steady rain could screw up. He growled again and looked over his shoulder at me, tail drooping. I got your back, I told him. I lifted a section of my long leather duster with my staff so that I could hold the amulet in the shelter it offered. I looked only moderately ridiculous while doing so. I'm gonna get a hat one of these days, I swear. The tracking spell held, and the amulet led me down the street toward Wrigley. The silent stadium loomed in the cold gray rain. Mouse, still snuffling dutifully, abruptly turned down another alley, his steps hurrying to a lope. I propped up my coat and consulted the amulet again. I was so busy feeling damp and cold and self-conscious that I forgot to feel paranoid, and Kane came out of nowhere and swung something hard at my skull. I turned my head and twitched sideways at the last second, taking the blow just to one side of the center of my forehead. There was a flash of light, and my legs went wobbly. I had time to watch Kane wind up again and saw that he was swinging a long, white, dirty athletic sock at me. He'd weighted one end with something, creating an improvised flail. My hips bounced off a municipal trash can, and I got one arm between the flail and my face. The protective spells on my coat are good, but they're intended to protect me against gunfire and sharp, pointy things. The flail smashed into my right forearm. It went numb.
So what? You steal my keg for Braddock so his homo bee cinnamon crap would win the division? I'm gonna take it out of your ass.
And with that pleasant mental image, Kane wound up again with that flail. He'd made a mistake, though, pausing to get in a little dialogue like that. If he'd hit me again immediately, he probably could have beaten me unconscious in short order. He hadn't hesitated long, but it had been long enough for me to pull my thoughts together. As he came in swinging, I snapped the lower end of my heavy staff into a rising quarter spin right into his testicles. The thug's eyes snapped wide open, and his mouth locked into a silent scream. It's the little things in life you treasure. Kane staggered and fell to one side, but one of the canettes came in hard behind him and pasted me in the mouth. By itself, I might have shrugged it off, but Kane had already rung my bells once. I went down to one knee and tried to figure out what was going on. Someone with big motorcycle boots kicked me in the guts. I fell to my back and drove a heel into his kneecap. There was a crackle and a pop, and he fell, howling. The third guy had a tire iron. No time for magic. My damn eyes wouldn't focus, much less my thoughts. By some minor miracle, I caught the first two-handed swing on my staff. And then 200 pounds of wet dog slammed into K-Net number 2's chest. Mouse didn't bite, presumably because there are some things even dogs wouldn't put in their mouths. He just overbore the thug and smashed him to the ground, pinning him there. The two of them thrashed around. I got up just as Kane came back in, swinging his flail. I don't think Kane knew much about quarterstaff fighting. Murphy had been teaching it to me, however, for almost 4 years. I got the staff up as Kane swung and intercepted the sock. The weighted end wrapped around my staff, and I jerked the weapon out of his hands with a sweeping twist. With the same motion, I brought the other end of the staff around and popped him in the noggin. Kane flopped to the ground. I stood there, panting and leaning on my staff. Hey, I'd won a brawl. That generally didn't happen when I wasn't using magic. Mouse seemed fine if occupied holding his thug down.
Jerk, I muttered to the unconscious Kane and kicked him lightly in the ribs. I have no idea what happened to your freaking keg.
Oh, my, said a woman's voice from behind me. She spoke perfectly clear English, marked with an accent that sounded vaguely Germanic, or maybe Scandinavian.
I have to admit, I didn't expect you'd do that well against them.
I turned slightly so that I could keep the thugs in my peripheral vision, and shifted my grip on the staff as I faced the speaker. She was a tall blonde, 6 feet or so, even in flat practical shoes. Her tailored gray suit didn't quite hide an athlete's body, nor did it make her look any less feminine. She had ice blue eyes, a stark, attractive face, and she carried a duffel bag in her right hand. I recognized her. She was the supernatural security consultant to John Marcone, the kingpin of Chicago crime.
Miss Guard, isn't it?
I asked her, panting. She nodded.
Mr. Dresden.
My arm throbbed and my ears were still ringing. I'd have a lovely goose egg right in the middle of my forehead in an hour.
Glad I could entertain you, I said. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm working.
I need to speak to you, she said.
Call during office hours. Kane lay senseless, groaning. The guy I'd kicked in the knee whimpered and rocked mindlessly back and forth. I glared at the thug Mouse had pinned down. He flinched. There wasn't any fight left in him, thank God. There wasn't much left in me, either. Mouse, I said, and started down the alley. Mouse rose up off the man, who said, Oof! As the dog planted both paws in the man's belly as he pushed up. Mouse followed me.
I'm serious, Mr. Dresden, guard said to my back, following us.
Marcone is only a king in his own mind, I said without stopping. He wants to send me a message he can wait. I've got important things to do.
I know, guard said. The girl. She's a brunette, maybe 5'5", brown eyes, green golf shirt, blue jeans, and scared half out of her mind.
I stopped and turned to bare my teeth at guard.
Marcone is behind this? That son of a bitch is gonna be sorry he ever looked at that.
No, guard said sharply. Look, Dresden, forget Marcone. This has nothing to do with Marcone. Today's my day off.
I stared at her for a moment, and only partly because the rain had begun to make the white shirt she wore beneath the suit jacket become transparent. She sounded sincere, which meant nothing. I've learned better than to trust my judgment when there's a blonde involved, or a brunette, or a redhead. What do you want? I asked her.
Almost the same thing you do, she replied. You want the girl. I want the thing that took her.
Why?
The girl doesn't have enough time for you to play 20 questions, Dresden. We can help each other and save her, or she can die.
I took a deep breath and then nodded once. I'm listening.
I lost the trail at the far end of this alley, she said. Clearly, you haven't.
Yeah, I said. Skip to the part where you tell me how you can help me. Wordlessly, she opened up the duffel bag and drew out, I kid you not, a double-bitted battle axe that must have weighed 15 pounds. She rested it on one shoulder.
If you can take me to the Grendelkin, I'll deal with it while you get the girl out.
Grendelkin? What the hell was a Grendelkin? Don't get me wrong, I'm a wizard. I know about the supernatural. I could fill up a couple of loose-leaf notebooks with the names of various entities and creatures I recognized. That's the thing about knowledge, though. The more you learn, the more you realize how much there is to learn. The supernatural realms are bigger, far bigger, than the material world, and humanity is grossly outnumbered. I could learn about new beasties until I dropped dead of old age a few centuries from now, and still not know a quarter of them. This one was new on me.
Dresden, seconds could matter here, guard said.
Beneath the calm mask of her lovely face, I could sense a shadow of anxiety, of urgency. As I absorbed that, there was a sharp clicking sound, as a piece of broken brick, or a small stone from roofing material fell to the ground farther down the alley. Guard whirled, dropping instantly into a fighting crouch. Both hands were on her axe, which she held in a defensive position across the front of her body. Yikes. I'd seen Guard square off against a world-class necromancer and her pet ghoul without batting a golden eyelash. What the hell had her so spooked? She came back out of her stance warily, then shook her head and muttered something under her breath before turning to me again.
What's going to happen to that girl? You have no idea. It shouldn't happen to anyone. So I'm begging you. Please help me.
I sighed. Well, damn it. She said, please. The rain was weakening the tracking spell on my amulet and washing away both the scent of the Grendelkin and the psychic trail left by the terrified Elizabeth. But between Mouse and me, we managed to find where the bad guy had literally gone to earth. The trail ended at an old storm cellar-style door in the back of the buildings on the east side of Wrigley Field, under the tracks of the L near Addison Station. The doors were ancient and looked as if they were rusted shut, though they couldn't have been if the trail went through them. They were surrounded by a gateless metal fence. A sign on the fence declared the area dangerous and to keep out. You know, the usual sound advice that thrill-seeking blockheads and soft-hearted wizards with nagging headaches always ignore.
You sure? I asked Mouse. It went in there?
Mouse circled the fence, snuffling at the dry ground protected from the rain by the L-track overhead. Then he focused intently on the doors and growled. The amulet bobbed weakly, less definitively than it had a few minutes before. I grimaced and said, "It went down here, but it traveled north after that." Guard grunted. "Crap." "Crap," I concurred. The Grendelkin had fled into Undertown. Chicago is an old city, at least by American standards. It's been flooded, burned down several times, been constructed and reconstructed ad nauseam. Large sections of the city have been built up as high as 10 and 12 feet above the original ground level, while other buildings have settled into the swampy muck around Lake Michigan. Dozens and dozens of tunnel systems wind beneath its surface. No one knows exactly how many different tunnels and chambers people have created intentionally or by happenstance, and since most people regard the supernatural as one big scam, no one has noticed all the additional work done by not people in the meantime. Undertown begins somewhere just out of the usual traffic in the commuter and utility tunnels, where sections of wall and roof regularly collapse and where people with good sense just aren't willing to go. From there it gets dark, cold, treacherous, and jealously inhabited, increasingly so the farther you go. Things live down there. All kinds of things. A visit to Undertown bears more resemblance to suicide than exploration, and those who do it are begging to be Darwined out of the gene pool. Smart people don't go down there. Guard slashed a long opening in the fence with her axe, and we descended crumbling old concrete steps into the darkness. I murmured a word and made a small effort of will, and my amulet began to glow with a gentle blue-white light, illuminating the tunnel only dimly, enough, I hoped, to see by while still not giving away our approach. Guard produced a small red-filtered flashlight from her duffel bag, a backup light source. It made me feel better. When you're underground, making sure you have light is almost as important as making sure you have air. It meant that she knew what she was doing. The utility tunnel we entered gave way to a ramshackle series of chambers, the spaces between what were now basements and the raised wall of the road that had been built up off the original ground level. Mouse went first, with me and my staff and my amulet right behind him. Guard brought up the rear, walking lightly and warily. We went on for maybe 10 minutes, through difficult-to-spot doorways, and at one point through a tunnel flooded with a foot and a half of icy, stagnant water. Twice we descended deeper into the earth, and I began getting antsy about finding my way back. Spelunking is dangerous enough without adding in anything that could be described with the word ravening. "This Grendelkin," I said, "tell me about it."
"You don't need to know."
"Like hell I don't," I said. "You want me to help you? You gotta help me. Tell me how we beat this thing."
"We don't," she said. "I do. That's all you need to know."
That sort of offended me, being so casually kept ignorant. Granted, I'd done it to people myself about 1,000,000 times, mostly to protect them, but that didn't make it any less frustrating, just ironic. "And if it offs you instead," I said, "I'd rather not be totally clueless when it's charging after me and the girl, and I have to turn and fight."
"It shouldn't be a problem."
I stopped in my tracks and turned to regard her. She stared back at me, eyebrows lifted. Water dripped somewhere nearby. There was a faint rumbling above us, maybe the L going by somewhere overhead. She pressed her lips together and nodded, a gesture of concession.
"It's a scion of Grendel."
I started walking again.
"Whoa, like the Grendel?"
"Obviously," Guard sighed. "Before Beowulf faced him in Heorot."
"The Grendel?" I asked. "The Beowulf?"
"Yes."
"And it actually happened, like in the story?" I demanded.
"It isn't far wrong," Guard replied, an impatient note in her voice. "Before Beowulf faced him, Grendel had already taken a number of women on his previous visits. He got spawn upon them."
"Ick," I said. "But I think they make a cream for that now."
Guard gave me a flat look.
"You have no idea what you're talking about."
"No kidding," I said. "That's the point of asking."
"You know all you need."
I ignored the statement and the sentiment behind it to boot. A good private investigator is essentially a professional asker of questions. If I kept them coming, eventually I'd get some kind of answer.
Back at the pub there was an electrical disruption. Does this thing use magic?
Not the way you do, Guard said.
See there? An answer. A vague answer, but an answer. I pressed ahead.
Then how?
Grendelkin are strong, Guard said. Fast. And they can bend minds in an area around them.
Bend? How?
They can make people not notice them, or to notice them only dimly. Disguise themselves, sometimes. It's how they get close. Sometimes they can cause malfunctions in technology.
Veiling magic, I said. Illusion. Been there, done that, I mused.
Max said there were two disruptions. Is there any reason it would want to steal a keg from the beer festival?
Guard shot me a sharp look.
Keg?
That's what those yahoos in the alley were upset about, I said. Someone swiped their keg.
Guard spat out a word that would probably have gotten bleeped out had she said it on some kind of Scandinavian talk show.
What brew?
Huh? I said.
What kind of liquor was in the keg? She demanded.
How the hell should I know? I asked. I never even saw it.
Damn it.
But, I scrunched up my nose, thinking, the sign from his table had a drawing of a little Viking bee on it, and it was called Kane's Kickass.
A bee? She said, her eyes glittering. You're sure?
Yeah. She swore again.
Mead.
I blinked at her. This thing ripped off a keg of mead and a girl? Is she supposed to be its bowl of bar nuts or something?
It isn't going to eat her, Guard said. It wants the mead for the same reason it wants the girl.
I waited a beat for her to elaborate. She didn't.
I'm rapidly running out of willingness to keep playing along, I told her.
But I'll ask the question. Why does it want the girl?
Procreation, she said.
Thank you. Now I get it, I said. The thing figures she'll need a good set of beer goggles before the deed.
No, Guard said.
Oh, right, because the Grendelkin isn't human. The thing is going to need the beer goggles.
No, Guard said, harder.
I understand. Just setting the mood, then, I said. Maybe it picked up some lounge music CDs, too.
Dresden, Guard growled.
I badly sang a bit of Everybody Needs Somebody Sometime. Guard stopped in her tracks and faced me, her pale blue eyes frozen with glacial rage. Her voice turned harsh.
But not everybody impregnates women with spawn that will rip its own way out of its mother's womb, killing her in the process.
See? Another answer. It was harsher than I would have preferred. I stopped singing and felt sort of insensitive.
They're solitary,
Guard continued in a voice made more terrible for its uninfected calm.
Most of the time they abduct a victim, rape her, rip her to shreds, and eat her. This one has more in mind. There's something in mead that makes the Grendelkin fertile. It's going to impregnate her, create another of its kind.
A thought occurred to me.
That's what kind of person still has her instructions taped to her birth control medication, someone who's never taken it until very recently.
She's a virgin, Guard confirmed.
Grendel can need virgins to reproduce.
Kind of a scarce commodity these days, I said. Guard snapped out a bitter bark of laughter.
Take it from me, Dresden. Teenagers have always been teenagers. Hormone-driven, curious, and generally ignorant of the consequences of their actions. There's never been a glut on the virgin market. Not in Victorian times, not during the Renaissance, not at Hastings, and not now.
But even if they were 10 times as rare in the modern age, there would still be more virgins to choose from than at any other point in history. She shook her head. There are so many people now.
We walked along for several paces. Interesting inflection there, I said, speaking about those times as if you'd seen them firsthand. You expect me to believe you're better than 1,000 years old?
Would it be so incredible? She asked.
She had me there. Lots of supernatural critters were immortal, or the next best thing to it. Even mortal wizards could hang around for 3 or 4 centuries. On the other hand, I'd rarely run into an immortal who felt so human to my wizard's senses. I stared at her for a second and then said, "You wear it pretty well, if it's true. I would have guessed you were about 30. Her teeth flashed in the dim light.
I believe it's currently considered more polite to guess 29.
Me and polite have never been on close terms. Guard nodded. I like that about you. You say what you think. You act. It's rare in this age.
I kept on the trail, quiet for a time, until Mouse stopped in his tracks and made an almost inaudible sound in his chest. I held up a hand, halting. Guard went silent and still. I knelt down by the dog and whispered, "What is it, boy?" Mouse stared intently ahead, his nose quivering. Then he paced forward uncertainly and pawed at the floor near the wall. I followed him, light in hand. On the wet stone floor were a few tufts of grayish hair. I chewed my lip and lifted the light to examine the wall. There were long scratches in the stone, not much wider than a thumbnail, but they were deep. You couldn't easily see the bottom of the scratch marks. Guard came up and peered over my shoulder. Amid the scents of lime and mildew, her perfume, something floral I didn't recognize, was a pleasant distraction. "Something sharp made those," she murmured. "Yeah," I said, collecting the hairs. "Hold up your axe." She did. I touched the hairs to the edge of the blade. They curled away from it as they touched it, blackening and shriveling, and adding the scent of burned hair to the mix.
"Wonderful," I sighed.
Guard lifted her eyebrows and glanced at me.
"Fairies?"
I nodded. "Malks, almost certainly."
"Malks?"
"Winter fay," I said. "Felines, about the size of a bobcat."
"Nothing steel can't handle, then," she said, rising briskly.
"Yeah," I said. "You could probably handle half a dozen." She nodded once, brandished the axe, and turned to continue down the tunnel. "Which is why they tend to run in packs of 20," I added a couple of steps later. Guard stopped and gave me a glare. "That's called sharing information," I said. I gestured at the wall. "These are territorial markings for the local pack. Malks are stronger than natural animals, quick, almost invisible when they want to be, and their claws are sharper and harder than surgical steel. I once saw a malk shred an aluminum baseball bat to slivers, and if that wasn't enough, they're sentient, smarter than some people I know."
"Odds bodkin," Guard swore quietly. "Can you handle them?"
"They don't like fire," I said, "but in an enclosed space like this, I don't like it much either." Guard nodded once.
"Can we treat with them?" she asked. "By passage?"
"They'll keep their word, like any fey," I said, "if you can get them to give it in the first place. But think of how cats enjoy hunting, even when they aren't hungry. Think about how they toy with their prey sometimes. Then distill that joyful little killer instinct out of every cat in Chicago and pour it all into one malk. They're to cats what Hannibal Lecter is to people."
"Negotiation isn't an option, then?"
I shook my head. "I don't think we have anything to offer them that they'll want more than our screams and meat, no." Guard nodded, frowning.
"Best if they never notice us at all, then."
"Nice thought," I said, "but these things have a cat's senses. I could probably hide us from their sight or hearing, but not both. And they could still smell us." Guard frowned. She reached into her coat pocket and drew out a slim box of aged, pale ivory. She opened it and began gingerly sorting through a number of small ivory squares.
"Scrabble tiles?" I asked. "I don't want to play with malks. They're really bad about using plurals and proper names."
"They're runes," Guard said quietly. She found the one she was after, took a steadying breath, and then removed a single square from the ivory box with the same cautious reverence I'd seen soldiers use with military explosives. She closed the box and put it back in her pocket, holding the single ivory chit carefully in front of her on her palm. I was familiar with Norse runes. The rune on the ivory square in her hand was totally unknown to me.
What's that?" I asked.
"A rune of routine," she said quietly. "You said you were skilled with illusion magic. If you can make us look like them, even for a few moments, it should allow us to pass through them unnoticed, as if we were a normal part of their day."
Technically, I had told Guard I was familiar with illusion magic, not skilled. Truth be told, it was probably my weakest skill set. Nobody's good at everything, right? I'm good with the kaboom magic. My actual use of illusion hadn't passed much beyond the craft's equivalent of painting a few portraits of fruit bowls.
but I just have to hope that what Gard didn't know wouldn't get us both killed. Elizabeth didn't have much time, and I didn't have many options. Besides, what did we have to lose? If the bid to sneak by failed, we could always fall back on negotiating or slugging it out. Mouse gave me a sober look.